Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
Jumping around and spinning and throwing his arms all around. And it was really fun. Like, there was something about the Kinect, and we never released the game.
Welcome to Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast, your place for resources and in-depth conversations with other game development professionals. I'm your host, John J.P. Podlasic. I've worked at 10 different game companies, starting back in 1989 with the TurboGrafx-16. Over the decades, I've developed games like Mortal Kombat, Avengers Initiative, Beavis and Butthead, and numerous others. I now work for a startup called Level X. But this podcast isn't about me. It's about you and the game development community. So if you have questions or ideas, give a call, 224-484-7733, or go to the gamedevadvice.com website. I have a great episode for you today, so let's kick things off with the new Game Dev Advice. I have a great episode for you today. We have Ben Perez and Tom Eastman, two of the three founders at Trinket Studios, a small indie studio based here in Chicago, best known for the game Battle Chef Brigade. I'm going to kick things off. Here we go. Okay, I have Tom and Ben here from Trinket Studios today. How are you guys doing?
Great. Yeah, doing good.
Excellent. Yeah, you guys have been going for a while with the studio, and I think there's going to be a lot of great advice and tips you're going to share today. Would you mind talking about what your current roles are?
Absolutely. So I'm Tom, this is my voice, and I'm the president of Trinket Studios, but since there's only three of us, I'm really just a programmer who has to deal with the most Twitter and taxes out of the three of us.
Twitter and taxes, that's the worst. Tease.
I'd say that Ben and I split production, but I do as much of the painful stuff so that Ben and Eric can focus.
Mm-hmm. I have far less hats to wear than Tom does, but consider myself a programmer first, but slowly getting the habit of trying to put the producer hat on when it's needed. So I think that's a skill that we've all been learning to hone up on here.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Just for those that don't know, what's the big game you guys have released?
We recently, over a year and a half ago, released Battle mm-hmm. Chef Brigade. It was on Switch and Steam, and recently, last year, came out on PS4 with a big deluxe mm-hmm. update. And so now we're wrapping up the art book is the last Kickstarter backer reward that we have to deliver.
I'm sure Eric will have some awesome stuff for that.
Oh, yeah. He's been doing an amazing job.
That's great. So I like to kind of like let people know how you guys got in the game industry. You mind each talking about how you got started in the video game industry?
Absolutely. So I was one of those kids who basically knew what I wanted to do from a really young age. At like third or fourth grade, I had narrowed it down to Major League Soccer player, astronaut, or game developer. And then I got too tall to be an astronaut, apparently, or to be a fighter pilot. And I wasn't really that good at soccer after all. So I set on game development. So I knew like early on. And so I was in high school. I took a lot of programming classes and did a lot of independent mm-hmm. studies, taught myself OpenGL and C++, made some really, really bad games.
Yeah, but you made them. That's great.
Yep. Yeah, that's the point, I guess. And those got me into Dartmouth College for computer science. So I studied like
really theoretical computer science, but I interned at Garage Games, the makers of the Torque game engine, which I think now all that has disappeared into the ether and been crushed by Unity, but it was, Torque was sort of like Unity before hobbyists could be anyone.
I remember Torque. You
really understand programming to be able to make games in Torque. But I interned there, worked on their 2D, they called it Torque Game Builder, for a while. And then I did some freelance work for them during college. And then my thesis advisor said, you better not just settle on the first company you work for. You should check out another company. I was a big Halo fanboy, so I knew about Alex Seropian starting Wideload. So I played Wideload and interned there, got on the Shorts team, which was sort of a, I called it a funded indie. It was like five people making really small games for phone and different online stuff. And that was sort of the dream come true for me. Then when I started full-time, Disney bought Wideload. And sort of my life plan, knowing that I wanted to go into games at such a young age, was to graduate, go to a big, medium to large company, like Wideload was perfect, and then stay there for 6 years. I don't know how I decided on 6 years. And then steal the best people to start an indie game company.
Okay.
I couldn't stand Disney for that long, so it lasted for 3 years, but then did manage to leave with Ben and Eric, so it all worked out.
Yeah, did still two very great people, so that's a great story. How about you, Ben?
Very similar story to Tom's, maybe a little less planned, but you know, I think you talk to people who are in games, especially sort of our age, I think a lot of them are going to say, like, I played video games when I was a kid, and at some point I was like, I should do this for a living, and you just ran with that for as long as you could. So, yeah, I was also, you know, a big video game nerd growing up, got into high school, got into math, and that sort of segued into senior year. You know, there was a couple programming classes that were available. I started taking those. I think that was sort of when the light clicked. It's like, oh, that's what you do to make video games. Like, it's not just about, you know, studying math or studying art. It's actually programming's a critical element. And that's actually what I wanted. It was definitely a sort of a unusual experience, knowing that I wanted to be making games, but I didn't really have the vocabulary for how I wanted to be doing that, but that was definitely the light bulb moment was senior year. So then coming out of a senior year of high school, I was looking around at colleges and I was living in Chicago. I've lived in Chicago my whole life. Saw that DePaul had a game dev curriculum that just sort of, you know, seemed like it was a perfect fit. So signed up, went to DePaul for 4 years. Oddly enough, didn't really start taking any game dev classes until like the end of my third year when I was a junior. So that was a bit of an odd experience, sort of like having to dip out from high school all the way through to junior year of college. I don't think I really did much in games other than play them, obviously. Right. But then junior year, maybe it worked out, I guess, because all of a sudden the last like year and a half, 2 years of college were nothing but making games. So DePaul, that was kind of an interesting experience because as compared to Tom, the DePaul game dev curriculum was supposed to be multidisciplinary. It was supposed to be, you choose a focus eventually, but otherwise you take multiple classes that, you know, you theorize about design, maybe you do some programming, some light programming, maybe you do some light art in some capacity like 3D modeling. And through that process, theoretically, you figure out what you want to do long-term. But I sort of already knew what I wanted to do, which helped, I guess, in some way. You know, I didn't have to wander and consider and fret over it. But yeah, so senior year of DePaul, I was taking a few different classes. One of them was, I think, a modding class that happened to be taught by Patrick Curry.
So I was going to think, that was my guess. Class. I'm like, Curry's going to be in this equation here. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, so definitely, I think, you know, looking back on it, a huge benefit of having gone to college here in Chicago, where there are still a few game studios, is often you'll find people who work at those studios, you know, also teach at schools. So that was definitely my aim was Patrick. He just, you know, pulled me aside one night after class and he was like, hey, you know, you seem like, you know, you're working hard and we're looking for an intern at Wideload. Was that something you'd be interested in? I said, yes. So started interning at Wideload. We were working on the sort of middle production of Guilty Party at the time. Started getting my feet wet doing UI work. And then, as Tom said, so sort of serendipitous, you know, a few months after I started as an intern, Disney bought Wideload, and as part of their infinite wisdom, they just graduated all the interns to full employees, and that's sort of where Tom and I's story join up, and Eric's really.
Yeah. No, that's cool. And that's cool that you have that Curry connection, because he has mentored and influenced a lot of people in the industry. So what do you wish you had known when you had started in the industry?
I think that's a really hard question. It's a really good one, but we've been reflecting a lot. After finishing Battle Chef, we had a lot of time to reflect on what we could improve in the future. And a lot of the things we should have learned earlier, we just didn't really understand until we'd gone through it. So a lot of things, we got a lot of advice from all sorts of people and read tons of articles. And I thought we were still pretty prepared to start an indie company and then do everything ourselves. But we still weren't prepared for burnout, for instance, after working on a game for 5 years, or understanding the importance of production, for instance, having producers who are really focused on a schedule, and thinking about, in my case in particular, dealing with answering emails or talking with lawyers or accountants and all the time that can take up. And I think we did get advice for oh, this will be really hard and you'll have to do these things. And we just sort of felt whatever, we'll figure it out.
Right.
Even if the advice seemed true at the time, it's really hard to put that into practice without having lived through the lesson itself. And so I think if someone had warned me about all these things, I still probably wouldn't have listened. Lot of the time, even today, I was giving advice to someone who's thinking about getting into the games industry. And I'm just sort of I mean, it's really tough and not a great career. It's really stressful. And you're at the intersection of a lot of creativity and technical challenges. And the money can be here or absent entirely. And I also have to give them the caveat that I knew those things going in and I still did it and I still love it. But it's still really tough. And so it's really hard to give advice or accept advice until you've lived it. And unfortunately, I think the games industry is just this crazy beast that you just got to tame yourself and no one else can really explain it to you.
Yeah, you have to jump in and just really absorb it to understand it. And that's what they were talking about. Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, this part does suck. Okay, now I have to experience it and figure out my way to the other end.
I think the other thing I would say is that, we've been indie who knows what that means anymore these days, but we're indie and we've seen a lot of people come and go in the time that we've been doing this ourselves. And I guess if I had to pick something that I would say, I wish I had known is, or I could have told myself when we started, is think very seriously about, if you're going to be an indie, whether you're approaching it from a sort of educational standpoint, are you teaching yourself something? Are you approaching it from a recreational standpoint or a passions or artistic standpoint? Those things all have their own merits. But at the end of the day, if you're going to stay doing what we do for years, you have to approach it from a financial standpoint too.
Yeah.
Not just about the technical ability to execute a game. It's not just about the, creative ability to make a fun game. You also have to be worried about things like, where am I going to be in 5 years? What will my priorities be in 5 years? And that's hard to answer no matter who you are, whether you're a game developer or not. But those are exactly the sorts of things that you need to start planning for if you're going to be making a game, because most people take at least a year or two to make anything. And honestly, probably most projects last longer than that. So yeah, just, budgeting your time and expecting everything to take, a few years at least, and being honest about, okay, well, can I do this for a few years? What impact will that have to future me?
And to your bank account and can you, sustain if it takes you that much longer and this deal doesn't come through and, do you have the wherewithal and are you, prepared for it? Yeah.
There's a couple of really important things that we see in indies all the time that we somehow dodged. And those are having savings before you start an indie games company. And having really good teammates before you do that too. There are a lot of solo developers and I just feel so bad for them because it's so much pressure and weight to take on yourself and try to tackle everything yourself. And so I'm really glad that I'm not doing this alone. Ben and Eric have been able to fill whenever I'm not capable of doing something, they can do it, and that we were never super desperate for money. Like, we got fairly desperate, and that's why we did a Kickstarter without really having a finished demo. But it meant that we weren't desperate the whole time. We were able to, for better or for worse, take our time with Battleship. Yeah.
Hats off to you guys, right? I mean, you've been doing this for 5 years, and degree of fortitude and, like, you know, just diligence to get through it, because a lot of people, I think, are naive about it, and they get into it like they don't plan, and then like a year in, they're like, wait a minute, I didn't get 1 billion downloads on Steam and I'm not a millionaire? What? You know, and I think sometimes people are naive what it takes, and the fact that you guys planned ahead, you had some cash reserves, and you approach it also as a business. It's not strictly artistic. You know, making a great game is like half the equation. You know, you have to get it to market and figure out how to acquire users and all those kind of things. Yeah, I mean, credit to you guys for doing this. And 5 years in, I remember when you guys left Wideload, I was crushed, but I am very happy for you and proud for you guys, because that's cool that what you've done, and you guys haven't given up, and it wasn't just peter out or anything. You guys are 5 years and you're still going, so that's great.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, it was 5 years on Battleship, but we actually left Wideload 7 years ago next month.
Wow, yeah, okay.
We made 2 mobile games first before deciding. Then we made those really quickly. They were 2 months each. And then we were like, let's make a year and a half long project. And that's when it turned into 5 years of Battleship.
Yeah, because Wideload went down in 2014, and you guys were out of there before that. So, yeah, okay. Yeah, no, that's good stuff. What about advice you would, give someone that, say, is in engineering or programming specifically? Like, what kind of advice do you have out there for people that want to further their career also as an engineer?
Well, I guess I want to touch back a little bit to what I said earlier about my path through to being where I'm at now. I will say that, I met a lot of great people at DePaul. I think I really did enjoy the curriculum there. And obviously, meeting Patrick was my gateway into the industry. But looking back at it now, I feel like I would caution people who are considering getting a degree specifically in game development, mostly from the perspective of, I don't feel like being exposed to all the variety of professions within game development is going to illuminate the path for you, that you're going to figure out, if you didn't know coming into it, whether you wanted to be an artist or a programmer or designer, having a shotgun blast of those things occur to you is not going to help.
Yeah.
So there are times when I wish I had actually gotten a computer science degree, because I think I might have just, come into the field with a little bit stronger of a background. So yeah, I think that would be my primary advice, is just, there should be plenty of opportunities for someone to figure out what they want to do in game development outside of school. Making that decision in school isn't the right course. And that sort of dovetails into another general piece of advice for everybody who's looking for their first job. And that's, you're going to have to work hard, and you're going to have to do stuff on the side to prove that you're passionate about making games. Mm-hmm. And so in the course of doing that, you should be able to figure out, what sort of specialty you're interested in.
Right.
It is one of those things too, where you have to have some resilience and some perseverance, and you have to be able to try to make something fail or make something that's not very good and just keep going. That's definitely a part of any learning process. And I think maybe it's a little lost on people who are first starting out making games. Like, there's this expectation that you'll be making things fun right out of the gate, but that's probably not going to be the case.
Yeah. And just to speak a little bit about just that general game development thing, I agree also, just as somebody that, has roles to fill and is trying to figure out how to build a team and all those kind of things, it's like, all right, what's their portfolio? Or all right, we're going to send a design test, or we're going to send an engineering test. There's a little bit of the jack of all, master of none type. It's like, well, what does this person do, right? And what are they great at? Not, what do they dabble in? But like, they can write amazing code, or they awesome modeler, or whatever it is. So yeah, I think you need to explore that, figure out what it is. But just dabbling in all these things, it's not necessarily setting you up for a future career, because again, you can't really illustrate anything specific done in excellence if you're kind of a jack of all, master of none type thing. That's just kind of my 2 cents. But yeah. And then what about, you guys been into it for a while now, like on the engineering front, to other engineers, I need to learn Unity, learn Unreal, C#, or this new language is cool. Those kind of things. Like, what kind of advice do you want to give current engineers that are looking to go to the next stage?
That is an interesting question. I don't know how Tom feels about this, but I grapple with this question myself somewhat frequently. The type of games that we make do not require us to explore new technologies particularly often, like primarily because we use Unity, but also because Eric, our artist, is amazing, but it's also always 2D. So like 3D will never be in our repertoire. That's not just something that wouldn't make business sense to start exploring. So I don't really know how, like, we haven't really had that many opportunities to explore other interesting tech challenges. And in fact, it almost feels like every time we try to explore that lesson coming out the other side is that was a total waste of time. That did not actually help us make this game any faster. And next time we should just do it the way that we can do things fastest, which is what we've always been doing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think that on our like current stuff that we're working on, our big focus is not on like innovative, new, unique technologies. It's more about how do we make games that are better, faster. We're still using a lot of like engineering tricks, and like we're on the cutting edge of C# features whenever they show up in Unity and what Unity supports, but it's not in service just like trying out new things. It's stuff that the player will never see other than the game being better. The things that are tools, especially, that allow us to iterate faster, play test more often, write code faster, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So like, I think that's an interesting place that we weren't in, I think, ever at Wide Load. It was sort of like, we just got to figure out how to make this work. And now we're at the level where we're like, we're progressing from how do we make this work to like, how do we make this into a sort of efficient business process of making fun stuff. It's sort of like working on like manufacturing.
It's Kanban. You're refining the process, like, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We're modifying the process and not necessarily the output. Yeah. If we can make a combine go twice as fast, then you get a lot more corn, even if it's not like the greatest combine ever or something.
Sorry. I mean, combine, the agile term, like it's just like continuous improvement, right? Like, all right.
We didn't even know that was a thing.
Nope.
We've been out of the agile game.
I'm going to talk to that Justin Fisher guy. He's Mr. Agile. Got that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I guess the one thing I would say is, you know, I think we need to do this a little bit more at Trinket Studios, but there are opportunities to, you know, consider technologies you're not using and then try them in a very limited case. I guess a very simple example for us would be at some point during the development of Battle Chef, our game had gotten so big in terms of not just code, but art assets, that every time we needed to make a build, which itself was becoming a more frequent need for a variety of reasons, you know, we're taking it to the convention, we're showing it. So we were just making the builds manually on our own workstations. And at some point we decided, okay, well, maybe we should take a crack at setting up a build server locally. So I just spent a little bit of time investigating that. And so I think that was useful for a period. But I think also the takeaway was at a certain point, I started spending too much time trying to make this build system fully automated and you know, support multiple platforms, support multiple branches. And while those things, you know, arguably would be nice, the amount of time I invested in doing that ended up being probably a net loss. So maybe the takeaway is, you know, sort of do your reading, due diligence, research, be aware of what the options are. And then if you decide to try them because you think it'll be a net gain for your productivity, try it in sort of a limited time scenario.
There's a lot of managing our trade-offs that really matters with such a small team, especially like, it's really easy as programmers to focus on the programming problems that we can solve. Sometimes our time is better spent, even if we're not as good at it, at something like marketing or just like pressing a button to make a build is great. But if that comes at the cost of like improving the website or like researching our competitors or something, then it was actually not the greatest idea to make a really elegant build system. And we run into that all the time. Sort of like if we accidentally build, like if we're making a building and we think it's going to be a gym and we build it to be an awesome gym, and then halfway through we're like, just kidding, this is a school now. Then we wasted a lot of time like setting up basketball courts or something. And that's like a really, really hard problem, and we sort of just rely on each other to like put up a flag when something is going in the wrong direction. And Eric is super great at that, where like if Ben and I are just like off in the weeds making some like little tiny fairy right. house or something, and then Eric will be like, hey, I need this feature for the art to look good. And we're like, oh, yeah, that's important, not what we were trying to like make really nice and elegant.
Yeah,
over
yeah,
here.
They call that, especially with engineers, it's like gold plating. Like I got this thing, and I'm just going to do this one more thing, and it's going to be awesome. And the thing is like, whoa, dude, 2-3 weeks went by. What the hell? You know, it's like, yeah, you have to time box it and have someone kind of keeping you in check. And do you guys are all in one space or sometimes remote? Or I'm just curious, like what's your work arrangement there for how you collaborate?
We work out of the Indy City Co-op. It's up sort of west of Wrigley Field. And there's maybe 20 indies who work out of here, mostly solo. I think the largest team is 4. So there's like, it's a really great atmosphere. But then recently we've been trying to make sure that we can support more working from home / remote work, so that as we grow older, our schedules become more complicated. So we're trying to make sure that we can retain efficiency while also like really using the flexibility we have as indies, because that's super great.
Yeah. No, that's cool. I think I knew of that place, but I'll have to Google it and check it out, because that's cool. So what about projects? Tell me like your favorite game or project to work on.
Well, I guess I'll always have sort of a bittersweet soft spot for, I'm not actually sure to what extent I'm allowed to talk about this anymore.
Oh.
Let's just say there was a project that we worked on while we were at Wideload at some point, where it was an interesting challenge, an interesting technical challenge that I was allowed to go play for a while. We got it working, and then literally the same day we decided we were moving on to another project. And it was one of those bittersweet moments of like, I got this working. And actually, in some ways, I'm relieved that we don't need to move forward with it. But at the same time, the timing on that was just not great. That will always be one of my favorite moments. It's like, I am absolved of this. I got it done.
I can sleep with a clear conscience tonight. But shit, yes, you pulled the carpet out from underneath me. What the hell? Yeah.
Yeah.
I think at least one of my favorite projects was, I forget what we called it, but on Wideload Shorts, there was a period when we got access to what became Kinect, back when it was called Project Natal. And we were tasked with just sort of like make a game using this so that it can be ready for launch. And the team sort of went crazy with different ideas. And one of them was really ridiculous. Raj, another programmer at Wideload, made Spaz Cache. And that was sort of a test of the tracking of the Kinect, where you had like maybe 60 seconds and you just had to like, you'd get points or cash in this case, for how much each of the bones it was tracking would move. So try to like move a lot and you get a lot of points, but to get a ton of cash, you had to like get it to break tracking by like hiding your limbs behind yourself, but like as fast as possible. So we'd have a lot of testing where Raj would be in there just sort of like jumping around and spinning and throwing his arms all around. And it was really fun. Like there was something about the Kinect, and we never released the game, but it turned into this sort of like really unique development environment where we were standing up and moving all the time while testing our games. And that is just like something we've never really experienced. We're both like adjusting our posture right now.
This is sitting at a desk, right? Not like moving around.
Exactly. And that was like really fun to be playing with new technology like that and just having this like totally free form experience. Then, as Ben said, it was a similar situation where like we thought we'd made something really fun, we'd iterated on it, and then it was thrown in the trash. But for that period, it was great.
Okay, quick question break. What are your thoughts so far? Do you have a topic idea, a question to ask, or a guest suggestion? Let me know at 224-484-7733 or on the gamedevadvice.com website. We can't license this. There's no merchandise we can even make out of it. Mm-hmm. What the hell?
Yeah.
No, it's always fun playing with new tech and seeing where you can take it and what kind of cool things you can do with it, especially back then. You know, that was, it's kind of commonplace or whatever now, but back then it had to be pretty cool to be involved in something where you're moving and it's like, whoa, this is totally new. It's like tracking and it's, you know, a hell of a lot better than the Wii. And So what are you curious about right now in the industry?
I'm really curious to see what happens with streaming consoles. Yeah. I feel like it's not actually that exciting. I think all of the consumer-facing features of streaming consoles are things that the average gamer is not going to be super mm-hmm. excited about, or at least I haven't heard of that many. But I think it'll have a pretty large impact on the development cycle. And, you're talking about developing theoretically for one platform, but having it be able to stream to any number of computers and TVs, mm-hmm. that sounds pretty appealing. But at the same time, I think it'll also, at least for indies, increase the sort of expectations that consumers will have mm-hmm. for features. Like, suddenly you're putting these big AAA titles on a TV streaming through your console, and it's going to be next to or alongside an indie game, and it'll be a lot harder to justify as an indie, like, well, why don't you have multiplayer? It's streaming in the cloud. It should be just as easy as, this sort of similar argument that's made about Unity. It's like, well, you all are using Unity. Why don't you just press the use physics buttons, and then there's just automatically, ragdoll physics, and everything works perfectly, and it's just like a little sandbox. And I think that expectation will continue to grow in the consumer base, and I'm worried to some extent about how much indies will be impacted mm-hmm. by that.
I'm really excited to see what happens with AR once it gets more mass marketable.
Yeah.
Especially in the context of like kids and teens, like thinking about the progression of sort of Pokemon Go, Fortnite, Minecraft, and then considering things like Snapchat and how they're all sort of linked. Like Snapchat has a performative aspect, but like Fortnite, you really have a performative aspect where you're like showing off for your friends, and you can have celebrities and like all be in this sort of semi-structured social environment. And I think Pokemon Go has like a lot of potential in that vein once AR is cheap mm-hmm. enough. And so I think there'll be something really cool where like probably kids and teenagers will take over some like bizarre AR space where they can hang out, but still game to some degree so that they can have like hierarchies and beat up on each other and have like, it's fascinating how Fortnite sort of took over some of that group chat mm-hmm. feel for groups of friends. And I think that's going to be so cool when that happens with AR, and they'll have like places in the real world or in their school or at home mm-hmm. to sort of build these shared experiences that are both virtual and real. That's going to be really cool.
Yeah, no. And you just think about, what a phenomenon Pokemon Go was, right? For a period there, it was just crazy. I remember driving home late one night through this little town it's normally tumbleweeds, right? And I'm like, what are all these people doing walking around? And I'm like, oh, they're staring at their phones. I'm like, oh my God, they're like out at 11 o'clock going through Algonquin, Illinois, walking around trying to collect stuff. And like my sons even went out and bought, battery packs for keeping their batteries going on their phones and stuff. So, it had like that flashpoint of, everyone was doing it except for me, the old man. But yeah, it was pretty phenomenal. And it's like, okay, what's next, along those lines, and AR and VR, when it starts getting price point gets down and the barriers entry are easier and you don't need a big ass computer to run it and all those kind of things, at least for VR. Yeah. What's going to happen? What's going to change? What's going to be the landscape? What about the, you talked a little bit about this, Ben, but like potential threats that you see to the game industry or things that you're concerned about besides streaming and indies and things?
I guess in some ways it's been a while now, but, Steam has constantly had that air of like race to the bottom sort of app store issue. Mm-hmm. Like, suddenly there's this big glut of games that are on the Steam, which don't represent like what we might perceive as good games worth, even looking at on Steam, and whether that, makes discoverability a bigger problem. I don't know. I guess it's odd to think about now, because I remember having those discussions while we were in the middle of working on Battle Chef. And overall, I don't feel like it impacted the release of our game that much. But I guess maybe that just speaks to the fact that our game was, some tier higher than some of the other much smaller games mm-hmm. out there. But I guess in general, discoverability and the constant price point dropping of certain genres and I guess certain tiers of quality. Apparently, it doesn't seem like AAA is particularly impacted by this in any way. It seems like price points hold pretty steady, but you know, the general economics of like, how do you get a consumer to shell out money for something that you spent a lot of time and money on yourself is always at the forefront of our minds.
Yeah.
I think there's an unfortunate sort of like slow creep of gambling into video games. And like the progression through from like expansion packs to DLC to microtransactions to free to play is getting closer and closer, already is gambling, at least according to some countries. And I think that that's like really disappointing. Like if you're playing games not for some of the other possibly still addicting reasons, but if it's just straight up addiction, I think that's really bad for games in general. Like it's really hard for EA to not do that or Zynga. Like they're sort of, they're in position to take advantage of people and it's really hard not to just do it. I think that's really terrible. And hopefully regulation can help stem that tide, at least for kids, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
That is a really weird spot where like the $60 price tag on games hasn't gone up in a really long time. So people are sort of taking advantage of other avenues, some of which are more acceptable than others.
Right.
And for better or for worse, it seems like gamers, capital G gamers, will get in an uproar about something, but it usually doesn't really affect the Metacritic or sales numbers. And so there hasn't been this sort of backlash against it that I would hope to see. There's some hope maybe like, I mean, Facebook games sort of came and went, maybe because people who are new to the games on Facebook or the games industry in general weren't like used to the different business models. And so maybe they learned eventually like, oh, this game is taking advantage of me. And then that moved to mobile. And I don't know if people have really escaped free to play on mobile, but maybe there's hope that it doesn't just end up as gambling on your phone.
Yeah, and this is recorded today on May 8th. So there's, I don't know if you guys saw it, but there's game studios would be banned from selling loot boxes to minors under new law. So there was a law introduced today banning manipulative design features in video games with underage audiences, including the sale of loot boxes. And that that just came out today. And yeah, to your point, I know over in Europe, there are some areas, some countries that are, it's illegal because, it can be, you're dealing with minors and sometimes you're dealing with people that have compulsion issues and things. And it's a slippery slope and it can be kind of sketchy. What's a funnier odd story from working in the game industry?
Oh, I think I might actually have one. So this was probably maybe 2 or 3 years into working on Battle Chef. We wanted to start taking the game around to conventions, start getting feedback on, you know, whether people liked it or not. Obviously, that's a little late in the cycle to be doing it, but that's what we did anyways. We also didn't really feel quite comfortable committing to something large like PAX yet. So we found out that there was a small convention or a smaller convention in Indianapolis, which is a relatively short 4 to 5 hour drive from Chicago. So we signed up to go to that and showed the game off. Everything was going well. And then unbeknownst to us, they had signed up a bunch of YouTubers, like very prominent YouTubers, to come out and review the games. And amongst them was Markiplier, who I guess is and was both a huge personality. And of course, us in our desire to get the game a little bit more publicity, just trying to find whatever we could grab. We're like, well, maybe we can go give them a personal letter. So we went out and we got some pizza to like think the idea over. And we ended up getting envelopes. Eric drew like little chibi characters of all the YouTubers on the envelopes. And then we went out and bought USB flash drives, put a copy of the demo on it. And we wrote notes to them saying something to the effect of like, hi, thanks for coming. Thanks for showing up to the convention. If you have a chance, we'd love it if you could check out our demo. And then we gave those to somebody at the convention and never heard anything back at all.
Yeah. So to make it even worse, they were supposed to just like come around and play all of our games. But not only are they super famous and like really most of the attendees were there to meet them, but it was also Markiplier's birthday, one of the days. And so his line was conveniently near the like indie games area, but it was also completely full of like teenagers. And so instead of being able to bring the YouTubers around to us, they were just like, yeah, we can give them a bag of stuff to look at if you want. So that's when we hatched that plan. It never paid off, but it was a lot of fun to feel like we were doing some guerrilla marketing.
Yeah, it definitely felt like this is our moment. We just have to be sneaky enough to flip the build into the right hands.
Years back, years from now, we're going to look back on this, and this was the turning point.
Yeah.
That's funny. It's like, what the hell, man? Check out the demo. So what's a game that you're playing now or excited about, you know, outside of making Battle Chef, like if you have time to play games still?
I don't think any of us have that much time anymore. I find myself, when I do have time, I play Slay the Spire, which is actually kind of great. I found myself gravitating towards games that are shorter and also ones that I can use with Steam Link. So I have a Steam Link at home. Slay the Spire, as far as I know, doesn't have a mobile version, but you can stream it onto your phone, which is great because it's also a one-handed game where I don't need to be typing. So I can hold my daughter in one hand and then like be playing cards with the other hand. It's a slow process, but it's the sort of thing. It's like I can be feeding her a bottle, but also, you know, play
That's
cards.
Cool.
So gotta find the games that, you know, fit into your lifestyle.
What was it called again? I'm not familiar with that.
Slay the Spire. It's on Steam and I think on consoles now too. Maybe just Switch, but it's a like deck building card game. Yeah,
it's really good.
Cool. What about you, Tom? Anything?
I have been playing very minimal amount of actual games. I'd say that most of my game playing time is playing other indies in development games, which I really enjoy doing. Like, it makes me a better designer and I try to give good feedback and all that. It's sort of great practice, but none of them have come out yet. So they're all secret.
I can't tell you about them. And to your point, Ben, too, yes, when your life changes, that you have to do different ways of gaming and figure out how to make it fit with your schedule. You know, you can't sit down in front of a console for 3.5 hours and do stuff.
Yeah,
so
totally.
Yeah, there is that need for, you know, mobile and shorter and quicker experiences. And yeah, that seems to be obviously a big trend just because people's lives are busy. And even if there is time, there is so much, you know, going for their attention right now. There's so many things they can do that it is harder and harder to get those long chunks of focused console time like you could in years past. Okay. Is there anything I should have asked you about but didn't? Like, hey, man, what the hell? Why didn't you ask me about this?
I think a great topic to talk with you specifically is the role of producers in the games industry. Because looking back at the time that we were at Wideload, I did not respect, I didn't respect a lot of people because I was a naive sort of little jerk, but, and hopefully that didn't come across too clearly, but like, I really thought like, oh, I've got this figured out. I can make a game. And looking back, I'm like, wow, I didn't know anything. And producers are super valuable. And I was just super focused on gold plating my own little part of the game. You know, like I remember on Guilty Party, the Wildly Short team was sort of tasked with, a few of us were tasked with helping out to add more of the like detection mini games to Guilty Party. I was having a blast. Like, they gave me a list of like 20 or something to do. And I just started going through them and I would come up with new ones that I thought should be in the game. And I just went ahead and added some of those. And then I remember being like so proud. I added this one that was like, there are a whole bunch of different gears and you had to like figure out how to put them together so the whole machine would turn, and I'd made it so like it was somewhat physically accurate. So like the teeth and the gears would mesh and like actually rotate. That was very much gold plating, but I tried to gold plate a little bit of each one of these and I got complimented on that. So that was a problem too. But this gear one was totally not in the plan. And I remember Patrick Curry coming around and I'm sure he was super stressed and he just come from a meeting where like everyone had been like, oh, when is this damn game going to be done? I was like, yeah, check out this extra one I made. And he was like, what did you do? And like, I thought like, oh yeah, I had like plenty of time, no problem. But from his perspective, the larger, more important business perspective, like, this was totally unimportant. I think I, like, sort of convinced him. I was like, well, now we can say that there's 50 plus instead of 50. But, like, I just remember, like, not understanding his perspective in that. And I was like, oh shit, there are things that matter more than just like the mini games in Guilty Party. There are better things that engineering time could be spent on. And I really didn't appreciate that. And I did the same thing on Avengers Initiative Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
And now looking back on Battle Chef, there's no one to blame but myself for a lot of those things where we took 5 years on something that we could have spent less time on. Like if a lot of times when I'm wearing the producer hat, it just straight up conflicts with the engineer programmer hat.
Those are tough hats to wear to be able to flip between those. Yeah. Like, this is going to be cool. And they're like, what the hell? Get done with it already. We got this other shit to do, you know, and it's got to be a little schizophrenic to try and go.
Yeah. And it's especially, I think tough on a small team where if we're having a brainstorm session or really a design meeting, because we also don't have designers and someone brings up something, I need to be careful, and I've not been careful in the past, of differentiating whether my response is from producer Tom or designer Tom or programmer Tom. And a lot of times I'll sort of mix those together and try to use, like, definitely for the worse, I'll use my like programming expertise to say that something is a bad idea because I feel a bit worried about it as a producer. And that's like really not great, especially for Eric, where he can't argue back against programmer Tom because he's not a programmer. Really, he should have just as much say in the design and probably the production as well. Like figure out those priorities. And so that's been like a hard lesson to learn, I think. And it's somewhere like, thank goodness Ben and Eric are forgiving. And there's that same aspect of sort of load balancing yourself can be really hard, where we added some features to Battle Chef that were just sort of, I perceived them as easy to do engineering wise. And we were feeling like, okay, art is the hardest thing on Battle Chef. So Eric is managing like 10 artists. There's not much Ben and I can do to help him there right now. So let's add this feature that's almost entirely engineering. And then that was just such a mistake so many times. It just sort of increased scope. And we weren't, like, for instance, one of those features, like, oh, we'll add like combat only levels where you can get on a leaderboard to compete against your friends or whatever. Maybe 2% of our players played those, but they added at least a couple weeks of Nintendo Switch certification because, like any network features that you have, add a lot of complexity. And so that was one of those things where I was like, ah, I've got some extra cycles. I can add this thing. And then it resulted in downstream a lot of extra work. And it's really hard to like be aware of that. But hopefully on our ongoing work, like, we're more aware of that and can make better decisions. Right.
Yeah, and that's where the producer comes in. That is more at the 30,000 foot level. That can be like, yeah, great. That, you know, that takes 5 days, but then it's going to add this, and that. You know, between internal testing and then certification and all those kind of things, and what's our ROI in doing this, and is that time spent better doing something else? And, you know, I remember at Wideload, again, Justin Fisher we were big into, you know, sprint planning and the Fibonacci sequence and stuff. So it used to be interesting. We would go in that back room and go through features, and we'd have, you know, discipline leads, and everyone would vote, and we'd put the cards down, you know, what we thought, just t-shirt sizing, what something would cost. And sometimes everyone would say a 3 or, you know, whatever. But other times there'd be these huge gaps, or someone would say like a 2 and someone would say like, you know, a 7 or a 9. And it's like, well, why is that? You know, in my world, it's a 2 because all I got to do is blah. And then the other person from the other discipline would be like, well, yeah, but then I got to do X, Y, and Z, and then A, B, and C. Oh, okay. And then they would come to like a consensus between the numbers and kind of meet somewhere. Or sometimes meet at the higher number just because they don't have blinders on, but they're just not as cognizant of the other's work that goes into it. And that would kind of help keep us a little bit more honest on what we were biting off, just because we had these different perspectives. And it wasn't just people from one discipline saying, well, yeah, that's easy, I can do it in a couple of days, and not knowing downstream what the other work is and things like that.
Yeah, I think I'd really love to hear from more of your interviewees, like what their sort of day-to-day, not just workflow is, but sort of their production mentality. Because I think, you know, I mean, I would say that we're probably still not great at it, but we've gotten better. But what we do for production, you know, for producing the game and setting a schedule is, I would say, not any sort of standard methodology that mm-hmm. we've heard of. And I think that's just the result of the fact that when you're in the stream, when you're in a week of work, you know, things just do not go according right. to plan. And not everybody's in the office at the same time. Like, we don't always, you know, we can communicate on Slack, but we're not all on mm-hmm. at the same time. And then, you know, it always has that feeling of, well, I could start the side conversation now and stop everybody, but that stops
right,
everybody.
Right.
So we've definitely gotten to this point where I think our production method is sort of try to do playtests at the end of a week from the playtests and using our own sort of internal guess as to what the next important system is, pick a system, talk about all the design and tasking mm-hmm. that's related to that, and then task it all out ideally on a Friday, and then everybody's off to the races over the weekend or starting Monday. And so far that's been working pretty well for us, but that, you know, hasn't been in place the whole time. But I think it's definitely a system born out of the fact that there's three of us and we're all sort of always overtasked and there's always more that we need to do and none of us can just wear the producer right. hat all the time. So I'd be really interested in knowing, you know, hearing from more people what their experience is with trying to wrangle themselves.
Yeah, no, that's good. And yeah, I need to reach out to get more producers on the show and share their experiences and other people that are doing indie and developing on their own. I think it's smart to, if you can, kind of do a lot of the planning and wrap up and all that stuff on Friday so that, you know, over the weekend or ideally Monday, when you come in, the table's set, you know what you have to do. And it's not like, all right, where were we? And we got to figure out the planning part and, you know, all those kind of things. It's like, all right, let's go. We're off to the races. And you can kind of start the week off with a clean slate and forward momentum versus trying to do planning or trying to recap things and stuff like that. Yeah. And there's all the tools out there. You know, there's Jira, you know, Handsoft seemed to kind of lost its market share for a variety of reasons. But yeah, there's Jira and sometimes Jira is too heavy. So there's always like Trello, you know, which was bought by Atlassian that owns Jira. So there's different tools out there and there's other smaller, lightweight kind of project management tools and things. But yeah, and there's other tools that are even geared more towards like cinematics or 2D type things. Cool. All right. Anything else to talk about? Anything you want to put a shout out to? I'll put some stuff in the notes and yeah, I'll have some stuff together. But any other parting words?
Thank you very much.
No, thanks. Thank you guys. I'm glad we were able to make this work out. It's been cool to see what you guys have done since leaving Wide Load Disney and how you're still going and on different platforms and all those cool things. So I wish you nothing but continued success and excited to see what happens in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast. If you found it interesting or helpful, please leave a 5-star review. I'd really appreciate it. And don't forget to subscribe. I have a lot of great episodes coming out. As always, I want to hear from you, the game development community. So give me a call at 224-484-7733 or reach out on the website, gamedevadvice.com. I want to know your struggles, your questions, and your ideas. Since the podcast is really about you, the fellow game developer, and our game development community. Thanks and take care.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom. noom.com and check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.